I know some of you know this story, but I just think it introduces the topic so well. This is from the New York Times, 2009, in a story titled, What Are Friends For? Last year, researchers studied 34 students at the University of Virginia, taking them to the base of a steep hill and fitting them with a weighted backpack. They were then asked to estimate the steepness of the hill. Some participants stood next to friends during the exercise while others were alone. The students who stood with friends gave lower estimates of the steepness of the hill. And the longer the friends had known each other, the less steep the hill appeared. You know, it's kind of like we could hear that in a pop song, you know, with you, all the hills don't seem so steep, you know. It's poetic. And yeah, I mean, what a simple little study, because it shows like how we experience the world is affected so much by how related we feel. Even something as simple as a physical perception of the steepness of a hill. Seems like that would be objective. Oh, it's steep. No, it's not steep. Well, isn't it amazing that how you perceive something that simple is affected by how related you feel? We are incredibly relational creatures. Even if you're an introvert, you know, people still matter so much. And so, you know, relating well and loving well, you know, is certainly can be the meaning of life or one of the big meanings of life. And we could think of our spiritual path as learning to love well. Our whole life is devoted to that. And, you know, when we think of loving well, we sort of want it like in a cartoon where two lovers are sitting on a couch, they're knee to knee, they're holding hands and their faces are like inches apart. And one lover is saying to the other, I'll be right back. I'm going to blink. That's how connected we want to feel. But often we feel more like this cartoon where two partners are together and one is saying to the other, of course I care about how you imagined, I thought you perceived, I wanted you to feel. And, you know, often our relationships are more like that. And not just with our, you know, intimate partners, but with our dear friends, with our coworkers, with everyone. And so tonight is really about taking the wisdom of our practice and applying it to relating well, to loving well. And of course, the first principle of relating well is loving kindness, basic friendliness. You know, when I moved to Boulder, I was struck by it not being as friendly as where I had lived. And Lisa and I had lived in a tiny town in Western Colorado, 3,000 people, the closest stoplight is 35 miles. We loved it. And people are so relaxed and friendly and neighborly. And moving to Boulder was a little bit like coming to LA East, where everyone's caffeinated, super smart, super ambitious, you know, and not as friendly as I would have wanted. And to me, it doesn't make sense not to be friendly. I mean, we're all here on this planet for a short time. You know, what do we want to do with our lives? Do we want to be so busy? I mean, so, you know, there's a reality need, yeah, but there's also the need to really relax and be where we are and have this kind of basic friendliness. And, you know, like the Dalai Lama, it's not trivial when he says my religion is kindness. You know, the Dalai Lama is someone who got his PhD in Buddhist philosophy at age of 16, his Geshe degree. He's steeped, you know, in the 33, you know, understandings of emptiness, you know, the deep philosophy of Madhyamaka, and yet he can make it so simple. My religion is kindness. And so why is kindness sometimes hard? And why is loving well sometimes hard? Our ability to love is not some pre-given trait. Oh, this person's so loving, that person's so not loving, as if that's who they are and they're fixed in that way. No, our ability to love is a product of our mental habits. Just like this series is called The Practice of Joy, we can call it the practice of love. In the play and movie Wicked, Dorothy asked the bad witch, "How did you get to be so bad?" And the bad witch says, "Practice." Whatever you do repeatedly in your mind becomes your habit. Love is a practice. The more you practice kindness, the easier kindness becomes. The more you practice anger, judgment, the easier anger and judgment become. We're always, you know, conditioning our mind for more of the same. I did a retreat where we were doing metta, and I did metta. We were doing metta for neutral people. And there was a guy, kind of middle-aged, you know, sort of nondescript. He wore white every day. So, you know, he just didn't have a lot of obvious character features to me. And so I picked somebody who, you know, I didn't feel strongly about in any way, positively, negatively. But after a day or two of wishing him well, I started to really like him. I'd never said a word to him. I didn't know where he was from. I didn't know if, you know, if he was German or Australian or, you know, from California where the retreat was. I had no idea. But I started, you know, I started feeling really friendly to this guy. I really did want him to do well. And I would sort of like see where he was in the dining hall, like, and send him metta. So my heart opened to him just from a practice. So obviously kindness is so important to relating well. And, you know, mindfulness teaches us that we can't be mindful without kindness. If you're judging something in your mind, you can't be mindful of it. The very first move of mindfulness is kindness, in the sense of allowing what's here to be here. And this is a really interesting thing about mindfulness. As neurologists have studied what happens in the brain with mindfulness and meditation, what they've learned is that mindfulness uses the social circuitry of the brain. The same part of our brain when we're relating to someone is what lights up when we're sitting alone and meditating, which means mindfulness is relationship. We're relating to our inner experience and our outer experience. The inner is our thoughts and images and sensations. The outer is sights and sounds, that mainly, you know, there's a few other things. Either way, it's relationship. And so taking mindfulness into our outer relationships is easy because we're already building inner relationship. And it teaches us so many things about what's good relating. One is stay out of the big story, right? We really only need the headlines, but, you know, our mind wants to write novels like War and Peace, you know, novels. And, you know, but the headline is something like, "Did I check the mail today?" But then, you know, we have so much story around it. We relate really well to others when we don't make up big stories about them, because people are complex and changeable and mysterious, and we never really know who people are. This is a really helpful Dharma practice. Notice when you're making personhood statements in your mind about somebody. oh, that person is so loving, or they're so angry. That's a helpful person. That's a selfish person, you know, right? We're not just talking about what they do, but we're talking about who they are. And that really gets in our way. If you make those personhood judgments about somebody, if you say to somebody, you know, you think, well, that's a person who's really stingy. That's a stingy person. Well, the way our mind works, the exception proves the rule. We're just always going to think of them as stingy. Even if they're generous, it's like, okay, well, okay. Every now and then, you know, they do that, but boy, they're just stingy all the time. The more we stay out of that, the more we can just be with people as they are. So, and mindfulness teaches us this, that our big characterizations are just big stories. They're really not true, because people are many things in many contexts. So, and then, so this naturally leads to us letting people be who they are. When we bring mindfulness and kindness together, like metta, we could say, loving kindness is love purified by wisdom, right? This basic friendliness. Our heart becomes spacious, and our love can be like space, accommodating things as they are, letting things be as they are, but space meets things right where they are too. So metta is this, loving kindness is this beautiful marriage of love and wisdom. We just love people for who they are. So here's an example. Could we love this person as they are? And this is from the satirical newspaper, The Onion. The headline is, "Father only expresses love through concern for proper tire inflation." What? The article describes how, I'll just quote, "emotionally distant Earl Kolchak of Rocky Mountain, North Carolina, expresses his love for his daughter, Jessica, the only way he knows how, by inquiring about the pressure of the four Firestone radial tires on her 1995 Ford Festiva. Kolchak once took his love for his daughter a step further by personally checking the tires with a handheld pressure gauge, but later felt embarrassed by the expression of intimacy." Earl, he's such a guy, you know. Maybe for Earl, a feeling is, I'm feeling the need to fix my daughter's car. That's a feeling. Can we love Earl Kolchak just as he is? Kind of a, you know, not very demonstrative male. Again, our mindfulness purifies our ability to love. And mindfulness shows us how to love people just as they are. Mindfulness shows us the basic confusion we have, especially in our romantic relationships, between desire and love. And in the Buddhist tradition, we talk about love as just the simple wish that someone be well. To love someone is to wish them well. Think about your relationship with your partner or dear friend. You know, is your energy going more towards getting what you want or to wishing them well? We confuse the two. One is desire and one is love. And, you know, our relationships are complicated because we confuse these so often. So just to throw in a little humor on romantic love, and this is from the internet, so who knows, but I think it's kind of funny. Kid's perspective on love. Mike, age 10, in answer to the question, what do most people do on a date? On the first date, they just tell each other lies. And that usually gets them interested enough to go out for a second date. Callie, age 9, when is it okay to kiss someone? Never kiss in front of other people. It's a big embarrassing thing if anybody sees you. But if nobody sees you, I might be willing to try it with a handsome boy, but just for a few hours. Gary, age 7, on the role of good looks and love. It isn't always how you look. Look at me. I'm handsome like anything, and yet I still haven't gotten anybody to marry me. And Roger, age 8, how to make love endure. Don't forget your wife's name. So, again, desire prevents us from loving someone as they are. And I just want to read a little passage from Anne Morrow Lindbergh, Gift of the Sea. When you love someone, you do not love them all the time in exactly the same way from moment to moment. It's an impossibility. It is even a lie to pretend to. And yet this is exactly what most of us demand. We have so little faith in the ebb and flow of life, of love, of relationships. We leap at the flow of the tide and resist in terror its ebb. We are afraid it will never return. We insist on permanency, on duration, on continuity. When the only continuity possible in life, as in love, is in growth, in fluidity, in freedom, in the sense that dancers are free, barely touching as they pass, but partners in the same pattern. The only real security is not in owning or possessing, not in demanding or expecting, not in hoping even. Security in a relationship lies neither in looking back or forward, but living in the present relationship and accepting it as it is now. Relationships must be like islands. One must accept them for what they are, here and now, within their limits. Islands surrounded and interrupted by the sea, continually visited and abandoned by the tides. That's like love and wisdom, right? Just loving someone for who they are. And we can do this how? We can do this because we can handle our own emotions. So that's why last week's topic is so relevant. If you can be with your emotions, and you know, mindfulness, as we've done with RAIN, is the practice of being open-hearted, even if the going gets tough, staying open, not closing down to what is, but being with it without being swept away. That's the sweet spot. We fully allow our emotions without really believing them. And it's incredibly beautiful when we can do that, because then we stay so open no matter what life throws at us. So we love well when we aren't trying to manage somebody so that we can manage our own feelings. We can let people be who they are because we can just handle ourselves. So if we say something like, you make me so angry, that is not really taking responsibility for our emotions. And other people don't cause our emotions. They stimulate them. But what causes them is our needs. They're ours. And so owning our emotions as ours allows us to let people be who they are. If I don't know I'm anxious and I'm getting all controlly with my sweetie, Lisa, because I'm trying to manage my anxiety. Hello. If I stop and realize I'm anxious, then I can relate to that. And by doing that, then I can just let Lisa be who Lisa is. So mindfulness and kindness together is the sweet spot of relating well. We know that relating well means to love. And then mindfulness purifies our love. It helps us take responsibility for our emotions. And this allows us to let people be as they are. And then our love becomes like a big space. You know, we can just let a bucking bronco buck. A bucking bronco can't kick space. So this is a beautiful thing when love and wisdom come together. Our heart becomes space-like, but our space becomes love-like. Our heart is like big space, but it's imbued with light. And anyone who enters our space just gets illuminated by love. You know, this is the beauty of the awake heart, loving well. And then just a few more elements of relating well. Similar to taking responsibility for your emotions, nobody makes you angry. They might stimulate your anger, but your needs make you angry. Okay? This is somewhat similar, a little bit different. Own your projections. There's this ironic thing, the more self-aware you are, the better you can relate to others, because you know where you end is where someone else begins. We typically are just projecting what we think our reality is onto others and assuming if it's this way for us, it's this way for someone else. That's not seeing clearly. We own our projections. And I learned this in a psychotherapy training. There's the golden rule of doing unto others what they would have, what you would have them do unto you. But then there's a platinum rule, which is even better. The platinum rule is do unto others what they would have you do unto them. That's owning your projections. You know, so this whole thing about love languages, you know, we do for someone what works for them. I love it. In a way, it's so easy. If Lisa and I, you know, are at odds in some way, it's almost too easy. Really, all I have to do is buy her flowers. And it's amazing how well that works for Lisa. She loves flowers, loves them. And when I do that for her, I'm talking her language. It wouldn't do that much for me. I love flowers. You know, I'm a former biologist, but it's not the same. But boy, does that work for her. So ironically then, the more self-aware we are, the more we relate well to others because we own our projections. Then we're curious about what it's like for someone else. Okay. The last thing to say, this is really important too, is be willing to be vulnerable, of course. And I think, you know, women know this better than men because women, it's more acceptable as guys, it's, you know, it's taboo in our male conditioning. But we're learning and we're changing. Yay. A friend and I, you know, we had this level of being really good friends, but being testy with each other. And I would talk to my wife about it, like, I wonder what's going on with Jeff, and just seems like we argue and, you know, we compete with each other. And one time we went out to dinner and we were just sitting there and we'd gotten into some little testy thing and, you know, there was silence and And I took a risk. I knew it was a risk. And I said to him, I'm scared. And I was just like, oh boy, what's he gonna say? And he just stopped and he looked at me and he softened and he said, me too. And that moment changed our relationship. Just one moment that took courage for me to say, and man, it changed everything. So when, and we have to be, you know, willing, you know, to be smart, let's take a calculated risk, but be willing to be vulnerable. So all of this helps us love well. And I will stop with this and just see if you all have